नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So for those who are new here, if you've never been to these meetings, we have rituals which come to us from India and Thailand, and I always say to new people, just be an anthropologist and watch how we do it. Rituals take a while to get used to. And the beauty of this teaching of awakening is that whatever, you know, whether you like it or not, doesn't really matter. You just watch. So if you're new, you feel, what should I do? Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? You can be aware of that. The old timers just slip in and out, know what to do, they feel confident. And that's natural. You come into a environment, a social environment you've never been into, you feel a lack of confidence. And you've been here before, you feel confident. And that's just the nature of things. But awareness, you notice awareness is neither confident nor shy. And that's the magic of the mind. That there is a possibility in human consciousness which is very, very peaceful if we can just not get fooled by the various conditions, emotional, physical, environmental, cultural, that keep coming at us through our sense experience. In a couple of mornings ago, I was mentioning to the people who are staying here, Sangha and lay people, I came across a rather disturbing reading, for me disturbing, from the technology in South Korea. And apparently now you can be riding a bus in South Korea. Lisa, there's a chair up here. You good there? Okay. So you're riding on a bus in Seoul, Korea, and you're reading a book or probably looking at your iPhone or whatever. And as you approach a bus stop, the mechanical ventilation system shoots out the smell of coffee and donuts. And as it does that, and as the bus is stopping at the stop, there's an announcement which says, Dunkin' Donuts. Have good donuts and good coffee. And if you get off at that stop, there's a Dunkin' Donuts restaurant right there. To me, that's criminal. There's something kind of frightening about that, that consumer culture steals your attention. You know, and if you think about it, and I don't want to go into a kind of religious tirade against consumer culture, because that's boring and religious people are always doing that. But if you think about what's the most intimate thing you have in life, and that's your capacity to pay attention. Because everything else, your relationships, your world, everything else is dependent on how you pay attention and what you pay attention to. So it's terribly important, isn't it? And I Ottawa's not Seoul, Korea, or either is Toronto, but I think Seoul, Korea seems to be on the edge there. But still, what popular culture tries to do at times, not all of popular culture, but consumer popular culture, is give you some kind of hyper-stimulation to keep your attention. And it might be for consumer ends, to consume a movie, so you buy the movie. For political ends, so you consume the product called liberalism or conservatism or whatever, shopping and all the rest of it. So there's a tendency to make the sense experience more and more exaggerated, more and more exciting, frightening, horrible, whatever it is. And then people come here or anywhere in a kind of quiet environment, and their minds also appreciate the lack of stimulation. There is stimulation. It's the sound of a robin or the beauty of a cloud. It's a different kind of stimulation. It's a more like a calming, natural soothing of the mind, I think, until the mosquitoes come, and then it's another experience. And you're back in Ontario rather than... But I mean, and that's very important to notice how our attention is affected by how we pay attention and what we pay attention to. And a lot of the ways that we pay attention has become just habitual. You know, you think about like a tendency to worry or to feel annoyed. It just becomes a kind of, you know, something triggers off annoyance in me, and my mind just, the attention that I have, the possibility of attention, becomes engaged with some kind of resentful thinking. Why do they do this and why don't they do that? And I'm kidnapped. You know, I'm kidnapped by habit. Now, this isn't an external thing. It's not Dunkin' Donuts. It's Dunkin' Vera Dunbar, you know, kind of coming through in this way. And so there's not only the kind of external stimuli of a consumer culture, there's the internal problem of habit. So what we're trying to do in the kind of Buddhist path is both find wholesome ways of paying attention, wholesome objects to pay attention to, so our attention has a sense of wholesomeness behind it, and then also we're investigating the very nature of paying attention, not just the objects, but the very nature of being attentive or being awake, and that is often missed. So in this meditation I suggested as we started of just listening, feeling the body, very simple, but hopefully by toggling between those two, sound, body, you notice actually there's a background of still consciousness, of still awareness, and that is not an object. You know, it's not hot or cold, it's not the wind, it's not the body, it's the awake mind. And that reference point gets very lost when our only reference point is the emotions or the thoughts or the stimulation we get from the sensual experiences we have. That gets lost. So it's a kind of double bind of a culture that doesn't have that sense of peace in it, or spirituality, whatever you like to call it. There's the bind of just being stimulated towards greed, hatred, and delusion by various factors, but also that awareness is no longer available, or attention is no longer available to itself, as it were. When I suggest this meditation on sound, body, what becomes apparent is, well, when I don't attach to the sound or the body or my thoughts, awareness is there, it's available. And in that very availability, I begin to find peace. And even if it changes, even if like the door keeps bang, 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 right? And then you're really just aware, oh, that's just unpleasant. And you stay with the awareness, then the unpleasantness isn't a problem. It's not a problem, because awareness is neither pleasant or unpleasant. And you begin to see that if you can train in this way to free your attention from the pleasant and unpleasant, one can still engage in the world of music or whatever art you want, but you can use it skillfully to calm the mind. But what to me seems most important in the use of cultural formats is cultural stimulations, whatever, is that awakened mind. So someone like as monks, we don't have music, we just have monotone chanting, which is usually off key. It's quite painful. It's one of the great regrets I have in this life. And my voice is now cracks after 5 minutes. I have a 68-year-old voice and just cracks all the time. So I used to really love chanting, can't do that. So in this monastery, we don't use Gregorian chant. And yet, in Western culture, the use of sound can be very calming. Very, very, very beautiful in that way. But what we would look at, say, just talking about cultural formats, is there then, like, if something calms you, do you then have a need for the object? Because if you have a need for the object, then you've gone beyond the calm to more attachment to the object. You've sort of overreached the point of of the object. And in spiritual language, we talk about symbology and idolatry. And usually that's in like say, in our iconography, if I bow to this plaster image and think, well, that's Buddha right there, and he's looking at me and saying, you're okay, that's idolatry, isn't it? That's idolatry. But symbology is that image reminds me of my own possibility of enlightenment, or my teacher, or whatever. Right? So that's symbology and idolatry. But in the same way, and this is like me, if you stretch that a bit, that consumer culture, it idolizes things. You know, whether it's an iPad or a Lexus, whatever, or it's a nice new frock, or I love that word, because I wear a frock. So I like it. That, you know, we idolize things. And things are not wrong or changing experience. We idolize experience. We think that in experience, somehow, we'll find fulfillment. What would we find? We find happiness sometimes. We find interest sometimes. We find fascination sometimes. We also find its opposites. It's just the nature of the game, isn't it? And that's the nature of conditioned experience, which is neither right nor wrong. You know, it just is the way it is. So the Buddhist teaching is just saying, okay, sense experience, emotional experience, cultural experience, familial experience, body experience, intellectual experience, they have a certain tone of beauty sometimes, and they have a certain tone of ugliness. So like just mentally, you can have really neat ideas, really stimulating ideas, and you can have really stupid ideas, right? Emotion, you can feel like really like open-hearted to all sentient beings, and you feel really bloody-minded. And you don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to do infinite compassion at 4 and I'll do bloody minded at 8. It doesn't work that way, does it? Because it's not you. It's not really, it seems like it's you. It seems like it's you. Like I'm the one that's producing this. But is that true? Is that really, really true? Am I the producer of the products that come into consciousness? Well, you're not. They're just natural phenomena which come from the various kinds of cultural, familial, gender, age, environmental conditions that this mind-body experiences. And this is very radical. This is very radical to see that this is, that the feeling of bloody-mindedness has a kind of equal weight as the feeling of deep compassion. Because they're both just conditions that come and go. But, there are some kinds of conditions that if you cultivate them and you work with them, they create a stability of mind. So compassion, if you encourage that and you enhance that, and bloody-mindedness or revengefulness or whatever you want, you don't encourage that. You don't encourage those thinkings. You don't encourage those attitudes. They lessen in power. And the things you encourage, what you pay attention to, and how you pay attention to it, you encourage those, you get a much more stable consciousness. But that's not the end. That's what we say, that is the method. That by creating a stability of mind, emotionally and environmentally and through the social structures that you live by, the more you can create a stability of mind, the awareness itself becomes interesting. And your mind turns to that very awareness rather than the objects of awareness. And that's where we would find what we mean by nibbana, or transcendence, or liberation, whatever language you like to use. So although I could say that like compassion itself is a condition that arises and ceases, I have the kind of equipment that I can encourage that in consciousness. But if I don't feel compassionate, and if I just feel really angry, I can also observe anger and say, this will change. This is all right. I'm not guilty for this anger. It just comes out. But I won't encourage that. I won't. So my attention now, what I pay attention to and how I pay attention, you begin to see it's very, very important. And this is where the Buddhist ideas of karma come up. that karma is intentional action, mental action, verbal action, physical action, but intentional. Like, not only can I pay attention, my attention has some motivation behind it. Let's say someone's sitting here, and I get this sometimes. I get, you know, monks get bored with what I talk about. I must admit, and they fall asleep. So yeah, I'm trying to give this great Dharma talk, and so then I look at this character, whoever, and I look at him, but I look at him with a particular viewpoint. It's like, will you wake up? Aversion. I'm not only looking at them, I'm looking at them with a particular intention. Hopefully if I bead them with my eyes, they'll wake up and get out of the room. And that intention of looking at them in that particular way creates a relationship with me and that person. It creates a relationship of somewhat alienation. And if I'm really stupid, I'll bark at them. And then I'll go back and feel regret and remorse and so on, right? So what I pay attention to and how I pay attention to it will condition the next moment, the next moment, the next moment. And this is what we mean by karma. Karma in Nepali is that karma is the kind of accumulated habituations of consciousness that we get involved in. It's the accumulation of habits. And you can see, if I was a real old grump, I don't think I am. You can do witness reports later, but if I'm, you know, I'm a real old grump, and I'm always looking at people like that. I'm like, well, you guys, you know, I'm just a sort of super disciplinarian in the monastery. You stop, you know. Then that becomes my worldview. So the thing that I'm most intimate now, my attention, sees the world as a place which is a hassle. And I don't see that actually I created that world. It's something that I did with my intentions and the way I paid attention to life. The opposite also true, that, okay, so I see that someone's nodding off, and then I look, and I maybe see the tendency, oh, will you come on, get your act together. And I see, no, I've been through that a million times. No, I say, have a good rest, mate. You know, go ahead, snore. Oh, I don't care. But now, you know, if I'm sincere in that, what am I doing? I'm paying attention, but now my heart is connected with compassion. And the next time I see the monk, I'll say something different to him. I'll say, you're right. Now you look really tired. And he might be embarrassed, or maybe he's really tired or whatever, but my relationship to him is much... And what it is, it's much more stable. It's not fraught by fear. It's not fraught by regret or remorse or anger. Now it's more connected. It's stable. So compassion and kindness, they're kind of stabilizing forces in the mind. And they are powers of mind. They're not just kind of accidents that happen. They do come up sometimes unbidden, you know, but we can cultivate them. And this is the idea of what we call bhavana, cultivating that which is wholesome and abandoning that which is unwholesome. The primary thing of cultivating the wholesome and abandoning the unwholesome is the awake mind. Because if you don't awaken to the way things are, and I simply come from how they should be, you know, how I should behave, how I should feel, then that's not awareness, and that usually leads to repression. It's not loving. Should be is not, we all know that, don't we? When I say to myself, Vidami, you should be different, that's not a loving statement, that's a judgment. An assessment is, you know, that guy might have just been tired. That's okay. That's all right. But a judgment, oh, very dumb, oh, you do this or over there, do that. That's just aversion. And these are things that we have to keep noticing in the mind. So if what we're trying to also say develop in Buddhism is a kind of second-hand attention, attention on attention. And this is a skill that a person who is just involved in the kind of animal responses to life doesn't have. But we as human beings have that capacity. You know, if we didn't have that, we'd be all crazy. So we have the capacity not only to feel love and anger, but to know, oh, love feels this way, anger feels this way. We have the capacity to see cause and effect, don't we? I can see that in a relationship where I just bark at people, it's a social disaster. When I'm more patient and so on, it's much more fun, much more nicer place to live. But that's not the project itself. That's the methodology. The project is something which is much more profound, and that's the which we call the unshakable deliverance of the heart, or enlightenment, or peace, or we don't use theistic terms in Buddhism. Well, some forms of Buddhism do, but we don't. So we don't use the God word. But if you said to a Buddha, you guys don't believe in God, you got to find out what God means. It's not such an easy question. So like let's Jerry Falwell or a born-again Christian, the same kind of definition of God that Pope has. So some of the words in our culture like God and religion are actually very difficult words. We think we know what we're talking about. Actually, each of us has a different definition. So the Buddhist language around that deep, 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 profound peace of the mind is something which is new to this culture, but existed in the mystical teachings of the Abrahamic religions when they didn't take God as in a kind of dualistic way. So you have language like unconditioned. And that's a kind of very exciting word, isn't it? It's not like all-embracing love throughout the universe. It's not that feeling. It's boring, unconditioned. But the trouble with attributing the transcendent or that deep peace or whatever, if you give any attribute to it, the trouble is you start to look at for the attribute. And notice that awareness is not an attribute. It's not like an appendage. It's not like a piece of furniture. It has no quality. It is unconditioned in that sense. It's not nothing. You toggle between sound and body. Sound, body, sound, body. So I feel myself. I do this because I have energy. I feel myself doing that. And I listen to the wind. There is consciousness, right? And that consciousness is not the wind and it's not that. There is awareness. What is that? You can't find it. You can't find it as an appendage. You can't find it as an attribute. You have to be aware, we say. You have to be aware rather than become an attribute. But as soon as you say peace, and I say, well, go to the peace of the mind, then you try to get rid of non-peace. And you get caught in this kind of dualism. This isn't peaceful, I want to be peaceful. Just relax, relax, relax. And you ever try that? When you try to relax, you get more tense? Yeah. You must have that in Qigong. So you start to just see that the relaxed mind feels this way, and the unrelaxed mind feels that way. Now, the relaxed mind certainly feels better than the unrelaxed mind, but we're not shooting for better. And this is the difficult thing. We like better. I always prefer better. I always prefer better. But I've seen over 1,000,001 times that better goes to worse. And worse goes to better. That's the cycles of life. It's natural. So then if I step just a bit back and I see, oh, this feels better than that, that the very knowing of that is neither better nor worse. I see better and worse as just part of the same package. So it's defined. It's like the hand. If you take the palm, you get the back of the hand. If you take better, you get worse. And rather than just making my mind some kind of homogenized skim milk, there still is better and worse. I still prefer not having back pain. Strange that way. I still prefer having a good stomach. But the way things are going, the prognosis is not good. It's all going to fall apart, right? And stomach will go and all of that. And we contemplate that. We contemplate that. If there is a transcendent possibility, it cannot be something about bodily. So we try to take care of the body. I try to exercise and do all of that because it just feels better. But bodily pain and bodily pleasure can be known. I can be aware of that, right? And then I do my best to stay healthy. Emotional pain and emotional pleasure can be known. And so we're constantly receding into that which is peaceful. And this is what we call taking refuge. And our monastery is called Ti Sarana, and Ti is the short form for three, and Sarana is refuge. And the idea of refuge is a kind of important one in Buddhism. Many people don't really pick up on it, but the idea of refuge is that, you know, what can you really trust? Like tomorrow, can you trust your body? Mm. You hope. You hope the thing will go for another 24 hours, right? Can you trust your brakes? Yeah, probably, right? Can you trust your accountant? Yeah, probably, you know. So you try to set everything up to be kind of secure. That's natural. But lo and behold, none of us can predict what's going to happen tomorrow. We just don't know. We don't know. But we're reasonable people. We're rational people. So, you know, we have our insurance and we have our mortgage paid and food in the fridge and coffee and so on. That's all set up. But what is that? Is any of that a refuge? And we know it's not. We don't think of that consciously. We only think of it when we lose it. Coffee machine breaks. Oh, and no refuge in a coffee machine. Sickness or whatever. And not to become like a wet blanket about that, but to see, well, what is truly refuge? And that is awareness of change. Now, when you start to bring that perception into mind, make that quite conscious, even if you feel lousy, something difficult, you do everything socially, intellectually, physically, emotionally, you try to rectify it, obviously. There's confusion, there's some difficulty, you know, you do your best. But doing your best doesn't always work out. It doesn't work out. There's other factors, many other factors. But awareness is always there. It always works out. So you live life, we say you live life at these two levels. One is the conventional level of doing the very best we can in our culture, with our families, being responsible, taking care of the land and the water, doing all we can. But you also begin to intuit that can't be the project. The furniture cannot be the project. The appearances cannot be the project. The only real project can be awareness of change. And then you begin to have this sort of sense of more and more equanimity. Because as long as the only place I can find fulfillment is in the objects, that always leads to a certain sense of despair. And by objects I mean not just like a clock or my glasses, but emotions and thoughts and relationships. They're all objects to awareness, aren't they? They all arise and cease in awareness. And you know, before we start a contemplative life, we always think, well, if I just get all that right, then everything will be okay. But all of us must have hit some points of despair, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And despair is actually very edifying. If it doesn't take you into some kind of abject depression, despair can be really edifying. It says, so what is it about? You know, what is the point of this existence? What is the point of my family and my education and my culture and all that? Is there a dimension which is different, fundamentally different? And you begin to, it's not there, where is it? It has to be here. It has to be in the heart, in the mind, somehow, in consciousness. And then you begin to, like in Buddhism, we talk about a sense of disenchantment or disillusionment with objects. Now that sounds like a bad state of mind, right? Oh, poor thing, he's no longer excited. And it's not like a lack of interest, it's just like, no, I've been down that road, I've been that road. So you become disenchanted. It's like, you know, as a kid I played with guns, I think. I can't quite remember. Or whatever I played with. And I became disenchanted of that. And then I played with drugs, became disenchanted of that. And then I played with trying to get enlightened. I get disenchanted with that. And then I thought, what is it? The teaching says it's here now. It's not a matter of time. It's unconditioned. It's uncreated. It isn't born, it doesn't die. So what is it? What, you know, as not as a human, like this body gets born and dies. So what is it that is not born and doesn't die? Well, what is it? It can only be awareness. And you begin to see, yeah, what, rather than always, so the desire mind is always caught up in what changes, isn't it? It was trying to change things to maximize pleasure, minimize pain. Then you start to ask the question, what doesn't change? Rather than, how can I change all of this? What doesn't change? And that's a kind of philosophical inward journey that we make. What doesn't change? Which only we can only make it for ourselves. And you begin to, well, my emotions certainly change. My partner really changed. my parents just died, or weather's changing. More ticks in the monastery. And you begin to say, well, what doesn't change? And you begin to see that the awareness of change is that which is unchanging. That's a very kind of subtle kind of thing, that by observing change, the changing objects point back to where freedom and peace lie, in the unchanging awareness of things. And this is very different from what the Dunkin' Donuts guys are doing to us. You know, they're saying, go out. And we have to go out. We have to live in the world. We have to function in the world. But is that all there is? No, there's more to that. And when we discover this sense of refuge in our own hearts, then actually functioning in the world is a much more joyous experience, because there isn't the demand that the world of experience be somehow fulfilling and ultimately fulfilling. It is as it is. Sometimes it is fulfilling, sometimes it isn't. But our fulfillment now is something that's always available. And so what happens is the greed mind, the fear mind, the anger mind, they begin to fade away, because now we say it's not about that, it's about this. And our tendency then to attach to fears, to attach to anger, to attach to greed, recedes or falls away, because there's a disillusionment with that. We no longer believe in that. So the mind feels jealousy. Oh, okay, you're jealous today, all right. We'll go tomorrow. You know, it's not a problem. Whereas before, it used to be a problem. Oh, I'm jealous. I shouldn't be jealous. It just comes and it goes. And you watch the change. And there's a kind of elegance and beauty to that. Elegance and beauty. But it won't, you know, it won't keep the economy going. So this is a very dangerous philosophy. It will help the ecology. You know, if you want to solve global warming... do this, be less consumerism. That's being facetious. But, you know, we still have to work in the world and so on, but, you know, the more one works in the world for the sake of being awake, then the response to the world is compassionate, service, moral, all of that. It makes a lot of sense. It's not forced on us at all. All right, I'll leave that for your reflections.